Wednesday night, choral music for this most solemn period of the Christian year by Poulenc and Messiaen. The concert concludes with the Requiem by John Rutter, which journeys from sorrow through reflection to healing and consolation. Radio 3 Live in Concert, Wednesday night at 7:30.
You're indeed listening to BBC Radio 3. It's time now for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Trevor Peacock is much loved throughout the land for many roles, but particularly for this one. Here's a question. Are you Jim, alias Trevor Peacock?
No. Yes, of course I am.
Yes, it's Jim, Trevor Peacock from The Vicar of Dibley. But his acting career has spanned many other horizons. For example, Shakespeare, Titus Andronicus, Feste and Twelfth Night. And what you may not know about Trevor is that he's had several hit songs, including Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter. How did that come about, Trevor?
Well, I'll tell you, once I'd got going as an actor, I was in a play about soldiers in Cyprus when there was the trouble between the Greeks and the Turks. And Caspar Vreder, the director, said, we've got to give them six new pop songs because they're not allowed to get saucy with the local girls and they must have something to do. So we need six good pop songs. You write them, don't you? And since I was already married and had two children, I said, yes, I write songs. And so I suddenly found myself, what am I going to do? So every day I used to look at a play as I drove into London to do the show, which was Othello, I think. I'd take a play and it would say a line that is possibly the beginning of a story, because the songs, I thought, always had to have a story. And so one day I picked up the play, Mrs. Brown, you've got a lovely daughter. Mrs. Brown, you've got a...
Right. And it was a colossal hit, wasn't it? Herman and the Hermits.
Yes, it was. About 4 months later, somebody said, rang me up and said, you're number three in the United States. And immediately everybody said, you know, the kids all said, we want it as a single. I believe it actually knocked Elvis off the, off the top in the end.
You mentioned Othello. Yes. Very difficult for me on this programme not to say Othello, because, of course, we always think of the Verdi.
Of course.
But we're talking about the play here.
Yeah.
And I think you were on a National Theatre tour when you first came across this first piece.
It was in Seoul in South Korea with a National Theatre's tour, yes. And one night we went into concert. It was Clifford Rose, myself, and Simon Brattleby. And somehow, because one was away from home endlessly, because we were weeks and weeks away in China and everywhere, music was the more precious. And we were all knocked out by this performance. And next day, we all went and bought a CD of it. And now when I play it, I suppose, what's that, 11 years later, it brings back the feeling I had of being missing my family and of seeing things going on in China, which I didn't particularly like, being in Tiananmen Square. And
fascinating, because Dvorak was such a patriotic composer himself, and folk tunes of his own land were so important.
Yes, yes, strange, isn't it?
Thank you. wonderful. You were really enjoying those triplets on the trumpets.
Yes.
That was the first movement of the Symphony No. 8 in G major, Opus 88, by Dvorak. The Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Davis. Curiously enough, it was another great conductor of English music, now sadly dead, who prompted your next choice, because I think you were at school with him.
Yes, that's right.
Vernon Handley,
yes.
It was at the proms, I think, that you heard him conducting the Walton Belshazzar.
It was.
And the piece has, I mean, I can see why it would appeal to an actor too, because it's very dramatic.
It is so dramatic. It is so dramatic. And the finger on the wall. You have been weighed in the balance and found wanting in this great Old Testament story. And if you just say it or read it, is not half as powerful as this.
Well, and of course, Walton had quite a strong connection with the theatre and the cinema, Olivier and things
yes,
like that.
Yes, he did, that's right.
He had a kind of feel for theatrical sound, I think.
Yes, he did.
Unfortunately, we've not got Todd Handley conducting here, but we have got Babylon Was a Great City, which is the bit I think you wanted.
Yes, indeed.
Babylon was a great merchandise was of gold and silver, of precious stones, of pearls, of fine linen, of purple, silk, and scarlet, all manner vessels of ivory, all manner vessels of most precious wood, of brass, iron, and marble, cinnamon, odors, and ointments, of frankincense, wine, and oil, fine flour, wheat, and beasts, sheep, horses, chariots, slaves, and the souls of
Bye.
Babylon was a great city. From William Walton's Belshazzar's Feast, we heard John Shirley Quirk there in declamatory mode, and the London Symphony Orchestra and Chorus conducted by Andre Previn. That is almost as close as you could get to a kind of operatic language, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And the music can say that so much more powerfully than just somebody speaking it. And so it is operatic, really, isn't it?
But the other thing, Trevor, which I think is important in both your profession and mine, is that, and I often say this on this programme, is that quality of silence. If you think of them as bum, 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 bum.
Yes.
It's the silence that then comes which makes them even more hammer blows.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And it's so dramatic and it thrills you. Music sometimes cools you down and sometimes just plays carefully and comfortably, but sometimes it goes mad. I think most of my lists have a bit going mad.
Except that the next piece is more intimate.
Tombeau de Couperin. Mm. Yes, that was strange. That came at a very joyful time in my life, I think. By then we were living in a nice big house in Richmond, and my children were there, Harry and Maudie, and they seemed to like it too. We all liked it. It was a family favourite. And so sometimes even, I think just remember Maudie when she was about four saying, "Play Tombeau. Play Tombeau." And she wanted me to play Tombeau.
She didn't know what Tombeau meant, presumably.
She thought it was the dog, I think.
It's rather nice, that form of Tombeau, or homage, where you pay tribute to a past era by writing something which is you, but nevertheless inspired by them, as it were. So here we have Ravel paying tribute to Couperin.
Thank you.
It was just another one of those pauses.
Absolutely, a dramatic pause there too. Curious, that rippling effect that a great pianist and a great composer of piano music can get, where the piano almost sounds like liquid, like water, cascading. Taking quite a lick there, quite a fast speed. Yes. That was the prelude from Ravel's Le Tombeau de Couperin, played by Anne Kefalek. Trevor, I imagine that during the war, the radio played quite a large role in all your lives.
Yes, it did. Because there was very little to do, you know. So the radio, I mean, it wasn't only Churchill's voice that lifted up people's spirits. They played a lot of music. All the shows had tunes, special tunes, you know, introduced them.
And the composer of this piece specialised really in light music, didn't he? Ernest Tomlinson.
Yes. He wrote a whole suite of
English folk songs.
English folk songs, that's
folk
right.
Folk dances, actually, I think.
Yes. Somebody once said to me, he'd love you to... Because I told them how much I loved Dix Maggot, whatever that was. Of course, it was after the war. In fact, I think he wrote it in the 50s. So the war had gone. And my life had moved on hugely then. I was a writer much more than an actor by then.
Dix Maggot from the First Suite of English Folk Dances by Ernest Tomlinson, played by the Slovak Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by the composer. We're in a sort of English phase now, Trevor Peacock, aren't we? Because we're going to have Vaughan Williams next. And this is, I think, probably, if not his masterpiece, certainly one of his masterpieces, which is the Fantasia on a Theme by Thomas Tallis. Of course, we're going to hear Todd Handley again, aren't we?
Yes.
But what do you love about this music in particular? Because I find it very evocative.
Well, the thing is, of course, that you feel as though you're really going back all those years. There is something very ancient about it, isn't there?
And rather in the way that Ravel went back to Couperin,
yes,
Vaughan Williams goes back to Thomas Tallis.
Yes, but he goes back a bit further than Couperin. Yeah. That was 16th century music, I think.
And you know, he designed it originally to be done in Gloucester Cathedral. That's with the right. instruments spread out around the cathedral. So I can just imagine the marvellous sound yes. echoing around that fantastic building.
Yes, absolutely. It does sort of put you back into that period and you feel overwhelmed. And it is very old. We live in a very old house in Somerset. That goes back to 1460 that my house was built. And so I can sit in this great old stone house and listen to something
the musical equivalent of those great flying buttresses.
Yes, that's it. That's it.
Thank you. music from the Fantasia on a theme of Thomas Tallis by Vaughan Williams. We heard the London Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Trevor Peacock's old schoolboy friend, Vernon Handley.
Yes, and in that cathedral, as you say, there was sound. Suddenly you'd go into a pianissimo with a big orchestra, and then there'd be one violin playing. Amazing piece of music, I think.
Trevor, do you think that there's something quintessentially English about the humour in The Vicar of Dibley, which is what made it resonate so much with audiences?
I don't know. It amazed me. At that time, the synod, you know, the Anglican Church were discussing this terrible idea that women should come and be priests. Oh, you know, can't have that sort of thing, you know. I mean, it's irreligious. And so that's where they'd written it, I think. And I read it and I thought, it's not very funny. And then I thought, if you had a faith, you might be offended by such a piece of writing. It was a sitcom. And if you didn't, you want to watch it at any rate, you know. Hey, watch it. It's about a woman, priest, crumbs, you know. And yet it did catch on in the most extraordinary way. It's all over the world now. And she's a brilliant comedian, Dawn French. And all the other four were really mainly theatre actors, for five of us.
But they're very, very good ones.
Yes, and we knew what pitch to put it at. But and it did work, and it's gone on. I remember once when we were on the beach, and my wife had gone to the loo, and some young teenagers who'd been doing a project, you know, how many crabs they could catch and that sort of thing. And they said, "It's him, I think. You're him, aren't you?" And I said, yes, because you don't know what to say. So they said, "Make your noise, do your noise." And you think, what do I say? So I did, no, and all fall on the floor and curled up, laughed. And then one of them said, "Would you do it for my mother?" And I said, "Where is your mother?" She said, "She only lives down the road." And I said, "Well," and then my wife came out and she said, "What are you doing? Well, come on, we're late for lunch already. We've been asked to lunch." And I said, "Well, you know, I didn't want to turn them down." So I waited. And she brought this woman who was obviously her mother and who obviously had never seen the show. And she said, "Go on, do it. So I went, no. And her mother said, "What is he, a lunatic?"
And you famously had a great affection for Dawn French's bottom, if I recall correctly.
I don't particularly, well, it was a long while ago. I don't particularly remember that. But yes, she was a well-built girl. In fact, you've probably seen in the news, she's lost 5 stone and is really very slim. She was always a very dishy lady. Mm. Yes.
Gershwin next.
Yes.
But once removed, as it were, because we're hearing Miles Davis performing it, aren't we?
That's right. It's Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, which is a wonderful score, isn't it? And I've written 5 musicals, you know, and so I know about how difficult it is to be a hit for a whole 2 or 3 hours. But Miles Davis, it was a great jazz man, and he had this wonderful fellow, Philly Joe Jones, who was called, great drummer.
I think he made an album, actually, of songs from Porgy and Bess.
Yes, he did.
Orchestra directed by the great Gil Evans, who... And it was the combination, I think, of the two of them that came up with some really marvellous sounds.
Yes, and we were talking about the gaps and the Big Bang at the end. I sometimes, when I do think things are getting a bit stale and I didn't have a good day, played the part quite well but didn't finish it off properly. I think I want to get excited again. Music can excite you as well as soothe you, and I just stand up and press the button and then I pretend I'm performing it.
Hit me with your rhythm stick.
Yeah.
Oh. That was fantastic. Gone from Porgy and Bess by George Gershwin, as realised by Miles Davis and Gil Evans. Wonderfully tight playing, wasn't it?
Wasn't it fantastic? Yeah. Yes. I can see myself standing there all by myself in the big room and doing that again and again, because it cries out the rhythm, that drummer. And then the way he plays that trumpet in different tone altogether. Gosh.
Another piece I know you go to quite often, Trevor Peacock, and actually quite late at night sometimes.
Really? No.
I don't know about all your nocturnal wanderings, but I do know about this one. It's Shostakovich.
The Tenth Symphony is the one that I went crazy about and still do. I have a book about, what is it, Dmitrievich Shostakovich. It's fancy having a name that long. And I believe he kept the Tenth Symphony very quiet, didn't he?
He had to keep several things quite quiet, and then also talk in kind of aphorisms and in a secret language.
Yes, that's right.
I think that this for you also, you spent some time in Moscow a long time ago, didn't you?
I did, yes, I did. And I had a friend from school who was the journalist of the Telegraph. And he said, if you're coming, give me a call. And I rang him up. And in fact, within hours, there was a man in a raincoat following me around. And I used to turn around and say, sit down, I'll have a drink. But then he would take no notice of you. But one realised that one phone call and you were being watched.
But, and it is the stuff of plays and novels and the tension. There is an ominous presence, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, there was, I can't say about
yes,
that.
Yes, he lived in fear, didn't he?
Well, Stalin censored him, He went to Lady Macbeth Mtsensky's opera.
Yes.
And left at the interval, and that was it. It was off after that.
Yes. Russia made great plays and great novels and great poetry and great, great music, unlike anything that in any other country. And we owe a great deal. And yet they've always had to write with this danger that if they don't do the right thing.
Which gives the music a certain melancholy, an almost febrile melancholy, really.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's that feeling at the beginning, the first movement, so quiet, and suddenly the crash that comes in the second movement. Wonderful music.
Very powerful stuff.
Yes.
Music from the first movement of the Symphony No. 10, Opus 93 by Shostakovich, the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Simon Rattle. Your final music, Trevor Peacock, reflects, I think, both your love of France and the seaside.
Yes, it's wonderful. It's haunted me all my life. I remember when I was at college that they showed films, and if you went in the evening after studying, you could see films being shown. And I saw Monsieur Hulot's Holiday the first time then. That was a long, long while ago. But immediately I thought, this has got to be part of my life forever. My wife says, oh, you're not going to watch it again. But if you love France and if you love the seaside and you love Jacques Tati, who wrote it and stars in it, wonderful man, apparently died in poverty because his films are so wonderful, but he always paid for them himself. And was a great rugby player. You never think of him as a great rugby player.
Well, he goes up even further in my estimation.
But the great thing about the music is you see the French people coming on the trains and in nice cars and things, and then round the corner comes this creaking prehistoric motor car. It's got going the exhaust going all the time. But as he moves suddenly into the frame where there's the sea, and the music comes in at the same time as the waves, and then he uses it all the way through the film. But it's terribly wonderful. If you love France and music and Tati, you must put it on your television.
Quel temps fait-il à Paris, from Monsieur Hulot's Holiday, by Alain Romand. Well, thank you very much, Trevor Peacock. I have to tell you that I think I shall remember Jim Trott's Holiday in Australia and the mother that had never seen it. I think that's a hilarious story.
Yes, well, I've enjoyed it. Isn't it wonderful just to sit and listen to music? And I wish I could have written music of that sort, but just corny old pop songs for me. I did write some good songs in the musicals that I did.
I think it's wonderful to have had the success you've had in two completely different disciplines.
Yes, I suppose it is, yes.
No, it is. Many thanks. Yes.
Thank you.
Trevor Peacock talking to Michael Barclay. Next week, the Sport Relief Initiative will be gearing up across the BBC, and Michael's guest on Private Passions will be the Austrian-born Premier League footballer Paul Scharner. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3. The producer of today's programme was Sarah Cropper.
On BBC 4.
Hello, good evening and welcome.
Sir David Frost looks at the art of the TV interview.
Any good interview has got to build. It's not the questions that matter, it's the answers they trigger.
Examining how they've changed over time.
Now, Robin, leave it.
I haven't started yet.
Imelda, she opened the treasure trove and then in the end said, do you want to see the shoes?
Did you threaten to overrule him, Mr. Howard?
I acted scrupulously in accordance with that advice. I did not overrule Derek
Lewis. Did you threaten to overrule?
Frost on Interviews. Tuesday night at 9 on BBC 4.
Well, a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly. Welcome to Radio 3 if you've recently tuned in. I'm here to guide you through the afternoon today, which includes a concert from Liverpool this afternoon in an hour from now. We're going to head to Leipzig before that to get a taste of what it was like in the city during Bach's time. Lucy Skeeping is your guide in the early music show. But with the time at 1 o'clock, time for a summary of the BBC News, read by Vaughan Savage.
An American soldier has shot dead at least 16 Afghan civilians and left 5 wounded during what NATO officials have described as an appalling random attack in Kandahar province. The soldier left his base during the night and went heavily armed into people's houses in nearby villages. He later handed himself in to the US military authorities and has been detained. Liberal Democrats at the party's spring conference in Gateshead have refused to endorse the government's changes to the NHS in England. Activists voted by 314 to 270 against a motion, backed by the party leadership, that supported the reforms. The result does not oblige the Lib Dems to scrap the health bill, as opponents had pushed for yesterday. The people of Japan have held a minute's silence to mark the first anniversary of the earthquake and tsunami, in which almost 20,000 people died. The disaster also triggered a meltdown at the Fukushima nuclear plant. There have been protests during the day against nuclear power. The United Nations and Arab League peace envoy Kofi Annan has been holding a second round of talks with President Assad to try to bring an end to a year of violence in Syria. But fighting has been continuing in the northern city of Idlib. One of the government commissioners examining whether Britain should have its own Bill of Rights has announced his resignation. Dr. Michael Pinto-Duchinski said the commission run by the Justice Secretary Ken Clark was deliberately ignoring the views of the Prime Minister and pursuing its own agenda. 6 British soldiers who died in a bomb attack in Afghanistan this week will be remembered at a service in West Yorkshire this afternoon. The attack was the deadliest on UK forces in more than a decade. 5 of the men were from 3rd Battalion, the Yorkshire Regiment. The weather. Most parts of the UK should be warm with sunny spells, with the best of these in the east. Tonight it will remain rather cloudy in western areas with occasional drizzle. Clearer skies in some eastern parts may give chilly conditions with some mist and fog patches. The BBC News and Weather at 2:30 past one.
Vaughan, thank you very much. As I say, we're going to be at the Philharmonic Hall in Liverpool for a concert by the Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra this afternoon. Alessandro Taverna plays Grieg's Piano Concerto. Christian Lindberg conducts, and also on the bill, Sibelius's mighty expression of patriotic fervour, his second symphony, and Nielsen's bracing hymn to the rising sun, the Helios Overture. Our Sunday concert begins at 2. But now it's time to reach back in time with Lucy Skeeping in today's early music show.
Thank you.
That was music by Johann Kuhnau, his church motet Tristis est anima mea, performed by the King's Consort. It's a luscious sound, isn't it? So why don't we hear more of Kuhnau's music? Well, the trouble is, his life was rather overshadowed by Bach. Kuhnau was a few years older, but they did tend to operate in the same musical sphere. Both wrote music for the Lutheran Church. In fact, Bach sometimes used Kuhnau's cantatas as models for his own. They collaborated in testing a new organ at Halle, and Kuhnau's nephew even became Bach's principal copyist. Probably the best-known connection between them, though, is that Bach succeeded Kuhnau as director of music, or cantor, at St. Thomas's Church in Leipzig. This was a very prestigious and sought-after job. Leipzig was the second most important city in Saxony, a centre of learning and commerce that attracted loads of visitors to its trade fairs, its opera house and university. And as you can imagine, after the extraordinary impact Bach made in the post, which he held for some 27 years, the city is now forever associated with him, leaving Kuhnau to become a mere footnote in Bach's biographies. The cantor's duties were extremely varied and demanding. He had to direct the music at the town's four main churches, the university and the Collegium Musicum. He also had to run the choir school, rouse the choristers each morning at 5 o'clock, supervise meals and teach Latin as well as music, and somehow still find the time to turn out a new cantata each week for the boys to sing, not forgetting special music for festivals and holy days. But on Good Friday, 1729, in the afternoon service, Bach presented the congregation at St. Thomas's with a new work of such power, such monumental proportions, and such a wide dramatic range that even those congregants who were inclined to doze off through the interminably long Lutheran sermons must surely have sat up and listened in wonder. It was the Matthew Passion.